Radio.
A History of Marriage, Nature, Culture and the Present Crisis. A presentation by Dr. David Van Gend at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium.
Now, marriage, getting to the heart of it, is a man-woman thing in culture because the breeding pair is a female-male thing in nature. Only man and woman can create a child. Only man and woman can give a child a mother and a father. So-called same-sex marriage has no foundation in nature. It cannot create a child. It cannot give a child both a mother and a father. In fact, same-sex marriage would make it impossible for a child to have both a mother and a father, and that is an injustice against future children. Now, same-sex couples, the 1% of all couples, according to the Bureau of Statistics, are free to live as they choose, but they're not free to redefine marriage for all of us. They need to find a different word for their relationship, which matters greatly to them, but which is not marriage. Now, that is the short version of a history of marriage, nature, culture, and the present crisis. And that, of course, should settle the matter among all reasonable people, but it will not, and we are all now facing the long version. Our federal government has decided to give the entire nation a vote sometime after the next election on whether to redefine marriage to include adults of the same sex. Redefining marriage in the terms of this conference, David, is a dangerous idea. It redefines everything from parenting and kinship bonds to sexual morality and acceptable religious doctrine. And according to G.K. Chesterton, it is a terminally dangerous idea because, quote, this triangle of truisms, father, mother and child, cannot be destroyed. It can only destroy those civilizations which disregard it. End quote. The destroyers are at the gates. And to resist them, we must do two things. First, reassert the truth of marriage. And second, convince our fellow Australians of the harms of homosexual marriages, specifically that it will force future children to miss out on either a mother or a father, that it will impose radical homosexual education on all of our children, that it will silence conscientious objectors with the big stick of anti-discrimination law, and that it will radically deconstruct parenting and family relationships as well as marriage. But there is a prior task. Before we have any chance of convincing our fellow Australians, we have to win the right to put our case in the public square without media censorship and demonisation, to review this struggle, to get a fair hearing, and also to review the core content of our argument. May I show you a brief video that we put out last week during the Ryan Anderson speaking tour, of which we were the principal sponsors? Well, thank you. And yes, even today there are copies of our ad at the back. If you find these of any use for youth groups, for church notice boards, for schools and so on, just grab a copy or three or five and we can always send you more. So, that is the outline. And the first task is to reassert the truth of marriage. At a public meeting here in Hobart 3 weeks ago, the question put to us was, what defines marriage? The answer, in my view, is that nature ultimately defines marriage. The great natural force that brings male and female together to create new life. That is the ultimate foundation of marriage. The father of modern anthropology, Claude Levi-Strauss, defined marriage as, quote, a social institution built on a biological foundation. So marriage is not a social or religious invention. It is a social or religious recognition, that's the word. It's a recognition of pre-existing biological reality, male, female, offspring. All of our marriage laws and our customs exist to reinforce that biological foundation, helping to bind a man to his mate for the sake of social stability, but above all for the sake of any child they might create. And of course, not all marriages do create children, but typically they do. And an institution exists for the typical case. Married couples who cannot have children are still fully married because they fulfill the twin criteria of marriage. They bring together the two great halves of nature, male and female, into a one flesh union, and they are able to give a child, albeit an adopted child, the mother and father relationship that a child needs. A homosexual couple obviously does not bring together the two halves of nature. They cannot give a child, even an adopted child, that mother and father relationship. They do not meet nature's job description for the great project of marriage. Now, this is not a religious argument. The atheist philosopher Bertrand Russell understood the child-centered reason for marriage. He wrote in his 1929 book, Marriage and Morals, quote, "It is through children alone that sexual relations become of importance to society and worthy to be taken cognizance of by a legal institution," end quote. Homosexual relationships cannot create children, so society has no institutional interest in such relationships. They are of importance to the individuals involved and they demand neighbourly civility, but such relationships are not marriage. Now, surveying all of human history and culture, Claude Lévi-Strauss observed that the family, quote, "is based on a union more or less durable but socially approved of two individuals of opposite sexes who establish a household and bear and raise children." A recent observation of this universal phenomenon came from the Chief Justice of the US Supreme Court, John Roberts, in his dissenting judgment on same-sex marriage last June. Quote, "Marriage arose in the nature of things to meet a vital need, ensuring that children are conceived by a mother and father committed to raising them in the stable conditions of a lifelong relationship," end quote. Go as far back in written history as it is possible to go. Ancient legal codes of Hammurabi and King Dadusha in Babylon nearly 4,000 years ago, and they elaborate social conditions for valid marriage similar to our own, including the need for a formal contract, a public ceremony, and even obtaining consent from the in-laws. If King Dadusha had been a guest at the royal wedding of Kate and Will, he would have understood the Bishop of London's dissertation from the 1662 Book of Common Prayer as to why we have the institution of marriage. Quote, "First, marriage was ordained for the increase of mankind. Secondly, it was ordained in order that the natural instincts and affections should be hallowed and directed aright. Thirdly, it was ordained for the mutual society, help and comfort that the one ought to have of the other," end quote. Now note that the bishop's basic rationale is anthropological, not theological. That marriage exists to nurture a new generation, to discipline the feral instincts of males to constructive ends, and to be what John Locke called the first society, husband and wife, mother, father and child. This is the natural and fundamental group unit of society, as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights puts it. And no politician and no national plebiscite has the authority to repeal what is natural and fundamental to society. What King Dadusha would not have understood, and what no other king or philosopher in the last 4,000 years would have understood, is that two gentlemen sitting in the pews at the royal wedding, Sir Elton John and his partner David Furnish, would soon thereafter have their homosexual relationship elevated by English law to the honourable estate of marriage. Homosexual and bisexual relationships are recorded in history, but never as an institution of marriage, since it served no vital social purpose. The ancient Greeks indulged homosexual relations, but they never confused that with the necessary vocation of marriage and family. As early as Homer, we find the word gamos to describe the relationship between man and woman, which we recognise as monogamous marriage, centred on the oikos, or the family home. The Romans gave us the word matrimony, made up of mater, meaning mother, and monium, meaning state or condition. Matrimony is the institution built around the state of motherhood. As a rare aberration that proves the rule, the ancient Romans did record one case of homosexual marriage in AD 64, but that was the Emperor Nero, whom the historian Tacitus described as, quote, "corrupted by every lust, natural and unnatural," end quote. I have not seen that historic wedding celebrated in any TV ads for marriage equality. Nero's same-sex marriage was consummated on a barge on the Tiber for the titillation of his guests. Tacitus said that the people of Rome believed that this act so offended the gods that it led to the Great Fire of Rome. If Tacitus is right, that Nero's homosexual marriage led to the fire of Rome, and the fire led to Nero executing countless Christians as scapegoats, including the apostles Peter and Paul, then a successor of those apostles, our guest of honour, Archbishop Porteus, should not be surprised if the same issue gets him thrown to the anti-discrimination lines. So the truth about marriage is that it is given to us by nature and affirmed by every culture because man and woman are uniquely empowered to nurture new life. Now, as to the harms of homosexual marriage, the first and greatest harm is that it forces future children to miss out on either a mother or a father. Same-sex marriage means same-sex parenting because marriage is a compound right. Under Article 16 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, quote, the right to marry and to found a family. Therefore, homosexual marriage involves both the legal recognition of an exclusive relationship and the right to form a family by adoption or artificial reproduction. But any child created within that marriage would have to miss out on either their mum or their dad. Now, of course, there are already tragic situations where a child misses out on the mum or the dad, such as the death or the desertion of a parent. But that is not something you would ever wish upon a child. And it's not something that government should impose on a child. But laws for same-sex marriage would impose that deprivation on any child created within such a marriage. Of course, there are already situations where broken families reform as a homosexual household, and nothing can or should be done about that. What we must not allow, however, is the situation where government facilitates the deliberate institution and creation of motherless and fatherless families. Finally, some people also raise the scenario of bad parents, abusive biological mothers and fathers. They argue that it's better for a child to have two loving same-sex carers than a dysfunctional pair of biological parents. Fair enough, but neither option gives a child what they need. We must reject both, restraining parents who would abuse their children and restraining governments who would inflict laws that institutionalise motherless or fatherless children. Senator Wong and others insist that because same-sex couples already have children by adoption or surrogacy, nothing's going to change with same-sex marriage. That is not correct. A number of states prohibit same-sex couples from adopting or obtaining a child by surrogacy. But a federal law for same-sex marriage would carry great authority to overrule any state prohibitions on same-sex parenting. It is a compound right. Same-sex marriage would become the nationwide permanent violation of a child's right, where possible, to be raised by both mother and father. It is a law with teeth. So society is faced with an inescapable choice, as Margaret Somerville, Australian ethicist and lawyer, says. The question of same-sex marriage, quote, forces us to choose between giving priority to children's rights or to homosexual adult claims, end quote. We have to choose. Interestingly, as you saw, when we asked 1,200 Australians in our Galaxy poll to choose between these conflicting claims, they chose by a margin of 3-1 to give priority to the rights of the child to have both a mum and a dad over the rights of two men to marry and create a family. In the media, however, the rights of homosexual adults always take priority. Our aim in the Australian Marriage Forum has been to create a more child-centred debate. We say that a child has the right to look up and see the only two faces on earth that reflect her own, the woman and the man who together gave her existence. A little girl should not have to look up and see two married men as her parents. Neither man can be a mother to her. Neither man can guide her as a mother would when she's growing from girl to woman, nor model for her the complex relationship of husband and wife. Likewise, any boy needs his father's companionship and example to help him become a man. No matter how competent and caring a lesbian couple might be, neither of them can be a dad to a little boy. So what do we make then of the bland assurances that it doesn't really matter, that science shows there's no difference for kids raised by homosexual couples? These claims are simply false, both on the social science and, more movingly, on the testimony of adults who were raised by lesbian couples. Heather Barwick is one such adult, the subject of Heather Has Two Mommies, I believe, that famous book. Raised by a loving lesbian couple, she said in March, a lot of us, a lot of your kids are hurting. My father's absence created a huge hole in me, and I ached every day for a dad. Same-sex marriage and parenting withholds either a mother or a father from a child while telling him or her that it doesn't matter, that it's all the same, but it's not. End quote. You heard Millie Fontana on the video. Katie Faust, who appeared on Q&A this month, wrote, "Our cultural narrative becomes one that tells children they have no right to their natural family structure or to their biological parents, but that children simply exist for the satisfaction of adult desires." End quote. As to the scientific evidence, sociologist David Popenoe states the obvious, quote, "Few propositions have more empirical support in the social sciences than this one. Compared to all other family forms, families headed by married biological parents are best for children." End quote. That is the settled science of 40 years of research. And therefore, any institution that deliberately deprives a child of one or other married biological parents is, statistically speaking, disadvantaging the child. Now, running counter to this established finding, a number of recent studies claim that children of lesbian couples do just as well as children of married biological parents. On the whole, these are poor quality studies with a biased self-selection process, too small a sample size to be significant, no control group to exclude confounding factors, and so on. They are useful for newspaper headlines that impress impressionable people, but they are no scientific basis for public policy. Nevertheless, they have achieved their political goal of muddying the waters and establishing the folk myth that kids do just as well with same-sex couples. There are only 8 studies in this entire field that meet the gold standard criteria of random sample selection and statistically adequate sample size. Of those 8 studies, 4 find that there is no difference for children of same-sex households, and 4 find detrimental effects for such children. Significantly, the 4 that find no difference are deeply compromised by subsequent findings of corruption in their database. Now, the most recent and the largest peer-reviewed study by Sullins this year finds that children raised in same-sex households have 4 times the rate of serious psychological problems and emotional problems compared to children raised by their own biological parents. Now, while that largest and most recent study stands, no lawmaker can vote for a structure of same-sex marriage and parenting that has been found to be detrimental to children. Having said all that, I've never thought that social science should be the deciding factor. No social science really answers the question that must be asked. The question of the fundamental injustice and primal harm of willfully depriving a child of her mother or her father. Take the analogy of children forcibly adopted from their teenage mothers, a government policy until the 70s, for which our leaders apologised in 2013. Just because a social science study might appear to show that such children are doing very well at school a decade later, they're competing very well in sport and apparently well integrated with their peers, does that say anything about the injustice done to them at the start by wrongfully removing them from their mother? The same applies to future children who would be deprived of a mother through government-approved homosexual marriage and adoption. Even if studies in the future could show they'd turn out just fine years later, according to the crude measurements of social science, nothing would make up for the primal harm done to the inner life of that little child. The second harm of homosexual marriage is that it will impose radical homosexual education on all of our children and our grandchildren, even against the wishes of parents. Because if the law says that same-sex marriage is normal and right, schools must teach that same-sex behaviour is normal and right. Children will have to be taught, with the force of anti-discrimination law, that the sexual behaviour of two men is no different to the relationship of their child's mother and father in marriage. We've seen this happen overseas. After the courts in Massachusetts legalised homosexual marriage in 2003, school libraries had to stock same-sex literature. Primary children were given homosexual stories like King and King. Some high school students were even given an explicit manual of homosexual advocacy entitled Queer in the 21st Century. And you've seen the interview with Rob and Robin Worthlin from Massachusetts. This conquest of the curriculum and usurping of parental influence over the moral education of their child is, in my view, a major cultural goal of the homosexual movement. In Australia, under the federally funded Safe Schools program, created by the Victorian Homosexual Lobby and funded under the former Finance Minister Penny Wong, you can read at page 10 of the 2014 booklet, Oh My God, I'm Gay, the following instruction for your child. And I leave out the most explicit passages. Quote, I'm bisexual, so I ended up thinking of myself as having two virginities, my first time with a chick and my first time with a dude, end quote. Yes, parents can object now and tell the coalition government to stop funding Labor's programs in our schools, but parents will be sidelined and treated as bigots if they object to such material once homosexual marriage is the law of the land. There are three major arguments to justify these programs in our schools, and these are the same three arguments that are used to justify same-sex marriage in our laws. The first argument, and you're very familiar with these, is that there is a plague of gay-based bullying in our schools. And the best way to reduce that bullying is to celebrate homosexuality in the curriculum and affirm same-sex marriage in our laws. That is a very doubtful proposition. The only large study I have found that has control groups, 1,000 homosexual and heterosexual adults, published in the British Journal of Psychiatry in 2003. In that study, the researchers found no increase whatsoever in bullying of gay men compared to heterosexual men, whether at school or subsequently, whether verbally or physically. The researchers noted, quote, reports that gay and lesbian people are vulnerable to such experiences because of their sexuality are often taken at face value, end quote. There are many reasons to be bullied at school for being too smart or too dumb, too fat, too weak, or even for being gay when you're not gay, but just defending those who are being bullied for being gay. That is something many young people go through, and the claim that homosexual people suffer disproportionate bullying appears to be taken at face value. It is important to address all bullying in schools. But an alleged plague of gay-based bullying should not be used to impose radicalised sex education on all our children. The second argument is that if we do not celebrate homosexuality in schools and celebrate same-sex marriage in our culture, we are culpable for depression and even suicide in young same-sex attracted adults. That is an increasingly common argument, and it is outrageous. On August the 12th, Sky News presenter Peter Van Onselen suggested to the Honourable Bruce Bilson, Federal Minister for Small Business, that the coalition would have blood on its hands because of its decision not to vote on same-sex marriage right now, but to hold a national vote in a year or two. He said, quote, can you first just explain to me why it is an acceptable thing the number of young Australians who are so homosexual who will commit suicide between now and when the government finally gets its act together to have a plebiscite on this issue, end quote. Can you believe that? On the same day in the Sydney Morning Herald, Justin Coonan, convener of the New South Wales Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby, specified that our full-page ad in The Australian was toxic and an example of, quote, the bigoted opinions that we know cause harm to same-sex attracted and gender-diverse young people, end quote. In an earlier report in the Sydney Morning Herald about our television ad aired during the Mardi Gras, the Director of Australian Marriage Equality, Rodney Croom, said our ad was, quote, actually harming the many Australian children being raised by same-sex couples, end quote. So do you see how this game works? If anyone even makes the case for keeping marriage between man and woman, the mere act of raising such an argument is actually harming children. There's only one solution: to shut up and agree with Rodney and Mr. Coonan. Breathing a word makes us culpable for depression and even death in young people. Can the gay lobby not see their argument for the emotional blackmail it is and the most uncivil insult to their fellow citizens who are simply defending the current law of the land? Now, nobody denies that same-sex attracted people do suffer disproportionately from depression and emotional distress. But never once in my experience as a GP Has that depression or distress been due to the bigoted opinions of straight society? It has always been due to something private and personal. Perhaps the trauma of domestic violence from a lesbian partner, or self-disgust at their own compulsive sexual behaviour, or unresolved rage at childhood sexual abuse, or the spiritual grief of holding values that conflict with their unwanted sexual impulses. That is what drives their distress and depression, not whether there are laws out there for gay marriage. We also know that gay people have close to double the rate of substance abuse, both alcohol and drugs, compared to heterosexual people, and that this is associated with increased depression and suicide. The previously mentioned study in the British Journal of Psychiatry cautioned, quote, "It may be that prejudice in society against gay men and lesbians leads to greater psychological distress. Conversely, gay men and lesbians may have lifestyles that make them vulnerable to psychological disorder. Such lifestyles may include increased use of drugs and alcohol," end quote. In Canada, where gay marriage was legalised by the courts in 2005, homosexual lobbyists in 2009 were still citing drug and alcohol abuse as much higher amongst gays. Changing the Marriage Act in Canada had not changed the dangers of the gay lifestyle. So, it trivialises a homosexual person's suffering to blame it primarily on the external environment. The associated claim that we must legalise same-sex marriage or be culpable for gay suicide is political blackmail. One does not overturn the foundational institution of society, with all the harm that entails, as an act of therapy for some depressed citizens. There are other less destructive ways to help. And the third and final argument for affirming homosexuality in the curriculum and in our laws is a powerful claim of justice, that gay people are simply born that way, so natural justice demands that they should have equal marriage rights. This moral argument has great influence on public thinking, but it is patently false and needs to be refuted. If God made them that way, a female Anglican priest asked me, how can we deny them their fulfillment as sexual beings? Or as Lady Gaga put it in her same-sex anthem, Born This Way, it doesn't matter if you love him or capital H-I-M, because God makes no mistakes, end quote. On the contrary, all of our lives are marred with mistakes of both nature and nurture, and we have to adapt. For some sexually confused people who suffer unwanted homosexual impulses, their capacity to adapt depends to a large extent on realising that they are not born that way. No science whatsoever supports the born that way theory. The American Psychiatric Association says, quote, "There are no replicated scientific studies supporting any specific biological etiology for homosexuality," end quote. Even the avowedly pro-gay American Psychological Association states no findings have emerged that permit scientists to conclude that sexual orientation is determined by any particular factor or factors, end quote. The director of the Human Genome Project, Francis Collins, notes that, quote, "sexual orientation is genetically influenced, but not hardwired by DNA. Whatever genes are involved represent predispositions, not predeterminations," end quote. So there is no justification for claiming gay people are born that way. There is no simplistic gay gene or gay brain. In the same way, psychological mechanisms are not sufficient to explain all cases. All we can conclude is that the phenomenon is multifactorial in origin, with predisposing and precipitating factors, a deeply ingrained but potentially modifiable psychological condition, not an innate identity. Senators at the May 2012 inquiry into the Marriage Equality Amendment Bill heard from a man, Ron Brookman, who had been actively homosexual for most of his adult life but is now married with three children. More recently, the founder of Young Gay America, Michael Glatzy, went ex-gay and married his girlfriend. In an interview, he said, "When you leave homosexuality, there's a sense of growing up. There is a sense of leaving adolescence behind, of becoming whole," end quote. Now, such men are not meant to exist under the born this way theory. They incur the wrath of the homosexual movement for showing they're neither born that way nor obliged to stay that way, that change along a spectrum is possible for some people to some extent. Consider the clinical findings of spontaneous change in sexual orientation. A large study in 2007 by Savin Williams found 3/4 of adolescents who had some initial homosexual attraction between the ages of 17 to 21 changed to experience exclusive heterosexual attraction. Another large study of some 14,000 young people by Ott and Corliss in 2010 found that 2/3 of those who thought they might be homosexual eventually became exclusively heterosexual. Now, what these studies show is that most sexual confusion in adolescence clears away if left to itself. My concern is that a policy in schools to celebrate gay identity among confused adolescents would be likely to encourage some young men to come out prematurely at school and lock themselves into a certain identity. When left alone, most of them would have got over their confusion and avoided the harm of a homosexual lifestyle. Now, in my view, these three arguments, powerful arguments, the bullying, the depression and suicide, the born that way justice, these arguments for imposing homosexual education on all children and for affirming same-sex marriage in our laws are scientifically dubious and likely to cause harm. None of them justify letting gay activists usurp the role of parents in determining the moral education of their children. Now, the third harm of homosexual marriage is that it will silence conscientious and religious objectors with the big stick of anti-discrimination law. In a graduation address at Campion College in 2011, while Dr. Daintree was president, the former Prime Minister John Howard said this: "Changing the definition of marriage, which has lasted for time immemorial, is not an exercise in human rights and equality. It is an exercise in deauthorizing the Judeo-Christian influence in our society. And any who pretend otherwise are deluding themselves." End quote. Canadian Queen's Counsel Barbara Finlay declared, "The legal struggle for queer rights will one day be a showdown between freedom of religion versus sexual orientation." End quote. So look to a local showdown. We all know how Rodney Croom, the head of the gay lobby Australian Marriage Equality, took offence at the recent pastoral letter by Australia's Catholic bishops entitled "Don't Mess with Marriage." This booklet conveyed traditional Catholic teaching on marriage to students in Catholic schools, but that was unacceptable to the gay lobby. Croom said in a media release in June, quote, "I urge everyone who finds the Catholic booklet offensive and inappropriate, including teachers, parents and students, to complain to the Anti-Discrimination Commissioner," end quote. In response, a Tasmanian Greens candidate has reported Hobart's Archbishop Julian Porteous to the commission. Significantly, that pastoral letter included this passage, quote, "People who adhere to the perennial and natural definition of marriage will be characterised as old-fashioned, even bigots, who must answer to the law," end quote. As columnist Angela Shanahan wrote about this episode, "Since when has teaching your children what you and most of the world's population believe to be right been a thought crime?" End quote. Overseas, under laws for gay, same-sex marriage, Catholic adoption agencies in a number of US states and in the UK have had to close when compelled by authorities to place children equally with homosexual couples. A judgment of the European Court of Human Rights found that if same-sex marriage is legal in a member state, then any church that refuses to marry same-sex couples would be guilty of discrimination. There should be no pretense in our parliament that churches can be guaranteed lasting exemption from the law of homosexual marriage. Equally, the individual will be given no exemption from holding approved opinions on homosexual marriage and parenting. David Blankenhorn observed, quote, "Once this proposed reform became law, even to say the words out loud in public, 'Every child needs a mother and a father,' would probably be viewed as explicitly divisive and discriminatory, possibly even as hate speech," end quote. Consider the hounding and sacking of the head of Mozilla, Brendan Eich, for daring to give a donation to a political campaign defending natural marriage. Or consider Mrs. Stutzman, a florist in Washington State, who gently explained to a long-term friend and customer that she could give him flowers for any occasion, but she could not violate her faith by decorating his same-sex wedding. She was prosecuted by the Attorney General, vilified in social media, and swamped with hate mail. The legal expenses and the toxic publicity will cost this gentle Christian grandmother her florist business. "Won't somebody please think of the bakers?" is the mocking line from gay activists. But it is no joke for father of five, Aaron Klein of Oregon, who was fined $135,000 and lost his livelihood as a baker, just because a lesbian couple demanded he bake them a wedding cake, and he, in good conscience, declined. Now, Senator Wong, in her recent press club debate, said, "Oh, lesbian couples like us would simply avoid bakers who didn't want to bake us a cake." But of course, the opposite is true. The whole objective is to identify those bakers, or florists, or photographers, or wedding venue proprietors who are not compliant with the gay agenda and force them to comply or break them. And in case we think the conservative side of politics will stand firmly against such intimidation, we read this month that a British conservative MP is calling for Christian teachers to be prosecuted under laws proposed to curb jihadist hate speech. We read, quote, "New banning orders intended to clamp down on terrorist propagandists should be used against Christian teachers who teach children that gay marriage is wrong," a Tory MP, Mark Spencer, has said. As everyone's favourite conservative Marxist, Brendan O'Neill, wrote this week, "Through gay marriage, the state, in the shape of the courts, the policing of hate speech, and the restructuring of moral education in schools, is exercising greater control over what can be thought and said about human relationships." End quote. Any law normalising homosexual marriage will be a truncheon in the fist of the thought police. Enforcing approved opinion on sexuality via their human rights commissions, it will be a major cultural triumph for advocates of state authority over individual conscience. It will be a major step in deauthorizing the Judeo-Christian influence in our society, and any who pretend otherwise are deluding themselves. The final harm of homosexual marriage is that it will not end there. Lord Daniel Brennan, former chair of the Bar Association in the UK, wrote in March 2012, quote, "After all, if you can abolish the most important precondition of marriage, namely that it requires a person of each sex, why should you be able to retain other preconditions, such as limiting it to only two people?" End quote. And in June this year, Chief Justice John Roberts of the US Supreme Court said in his dissenting ruling on same-sex marriage, quote, "It is striking how much of the majority's reasoning would apply with equal force to the claim of a fundamental right to plural marriage." End quote. You've seen on the video last year our thruples, female and male thruples, and our local Australian polyamorist Rochelle White. But why not? If marriage is truly only about love and commitment, then on what logical grounds can we possibly deny marriage equality to three or four loving and committed adults who want society to honour their relationship? Love is love is love, and love knows no boundaries. So beyond the extension of gay marriage to group marriage, the destructiveness of this revolution goes well beyond marriage itself to the broader bonds of blood and belonging. It is not just that the words husband and wife will be deleted from the Marriage Act. The words mother and father will have to go from various documents such as passports or birth certificates. And as in Canada, the legal term natural parent would be replaced by the soulless big government term legal parent. Under a law for same-sex marriage, the relationships of all parents with all children will be degraded. No longer a natural truth which government is obliged to respect, but a legal fiction, which the state will define as it sees fit. Brendan O'Neill says, "Those who say they're only words, who cares, clearly do not know they're Orwell. The policing of language is very often a policing of attitudes," he says. "A re-engineering of social values so they better accord with the elite's view," end quote. So we have no excuse for being lulled by Senator Wong's disingenuous words to the press club this month that nothing will change with same-sex marriage, that, quote, "the sun will still rise, children will still eat more ice cream than is good for them," end quote. We've heard from US activist Michelangelo Signorile telling gays, quote, "to fight for same-sex marriage and its benefits and then, once granted, redefine the institution of marriage altogether." We remember lawyer Paula Ettelbrick writing that being queer means pushing the parameters of sex, sexuality and family and of radically reordering society's view of reality, end quote. You've heard Masha Gessen about lying for the cause. These are not the words of homosexual people who just want to fit in with the established norm of marriage. No, these are the words of culture warriors who want to take marriage and remake it in their own sexually radical image. Monogamy is the essential repressive element that must go. On the same Sydney Writers' Festival, Australian activist Dennis Altman told us, quote, "I'm going to speak now as a gay man. One of the things about gay male culture is that it is not a monogamous culture. All the evidence we have suggests that monogamy is a myth. There are many long-standing gay relationships. There are virtually no long-standing monogamous gay relationships. And I happen to think this is a good thing," end quote. As the conservative gay activist Andrew Sullivan says, gay marriage can only be monogamish. Not monogamous, open marriage, not faithful marriage to the exclusion of all others. And finally, we have a novel term coined by a lawyer after this year's US Supreme Court ruling, the term wed lease instead of wedlock. The idea that marriage should not be a commitment voluntarily entered into for life, but an agreed term of commitment which expires after, say, 5 years, with the option of renewing the wed lease for another term. Thruples, monogamish, and wed lease will be in. Husband and wife, mother and father, and the natural authority of the family unit will be out. And we are being told that nothing will change. In conclusion, what is the way forward? How can we live respectfully with our homosexual friends, relatives, and neighbours while still protecting the truth about marriage and protecting that triangle of truisms, mother, father, child? Frank Brennan, the former chair of our National Human Rights Consultation Committee, wrote, quote, "I think we can ensure non-discrimination against same-sex couples while at the same time maintaining a commitment to children of future generations being born of and reared by a mother and a father," end quote. Now, non-discrimination against same-sex couples is exactly what federal parliament achieved in 2008, when 85 pieces of legislation were amended by a bipartisan majority, removing all discrimination in areas from tax to superannuation to Medicare to next of kin status, whatever. There is no unjust discrimination against same-sex couples in Australia. Gay couples have full relationship equality already with de facto or married couples. A gay couple in Australia has the same status and benefits as our former first couple, the Honourable Julia Gillard and Mr. Tim Matheson. And guess what? Neither couple needed a marriage certificate to achieve this equality. What Frank Brennan calls commitment to children of future generations requires that we do discriminate justly between two quite distinct social projects, the widespread public task of marriage and family, and the rare private commitment of gay partnerships. The number of same-sex couples in Australia is indeed very small. Only 1% of all couples, according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics in 2013. And only 1 in 1,000 children are raised in same-sex households. Given these tiny numbers, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, and given that same-sex couples already enjoy the exact same benefits as any other couple, just what is this terrible injustice that requires marriage and parenting to be redefined for the 99%. There is none. There is only a terrible psychological need on the part of the 1% for society to affirm the full and unequivocal normality and rightness of homosexual behaviour in our institutions, in our laws, in our schools, even in due course in our churches. Nothing less than total acquiescence and approval will suffice. And that, ladies and gentlemen, in my considered opinion, is the root passionate cause of this campaign for same-sex marriage. We have to refuse to acquiesce, not because we want to see our same-sex attracted neighbours continue to suffer psychologically, but because the treatment they ask for will not cure their distress. That distress arises more from the intrinsic dissonance of being a male erotically attracted to other males than from the extrinsic structures of society. Beyond that, we cannot and must not acquiesce because a gain in the rights of homosexuals means a loss of the right of future children to have both a mother and a father, a loss of the right of parents to guide the moral education of their children, a loss of the right of conscientious or religious objectors who will be silenced by anti-discrimination law. So marriage is given by nature, strengthened by culture, and uniquely empowered to nurture new life. It can only be and must remain a man-woman thing. Thank you.
That was Dr. David Van Gend with A History of Marriage, Nature, Culture, and the Present Crisis. This presentation was part of the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium on the topic, Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. For more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.